from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, round two of big politics this week. Democrats in Charlotte, the president makes his case. Bill Clinton shines again. Republicans hit back. Barack Obama's convention speech last night was sober. Optimism, he said, but also he said the truth about the path ahead.
Now, I won't pretend the path I'm offering is quick or easy. I never have. You didn't elect me to tell you what you wanted to hear. You elected me to tell you the truth.
Former President Bill Clinton lit up the hall, tore into the GOP with a smile, and said Democrats have the edge on ideology.
We believe that we're all in this together is a far better philosophy than you're on your own.
And Mitt Romney running mate Paul Ryan punched back from the campaign trail.
We basically have to decide whether we're going to stay on the current path we are on, a path of debt, a path of decline, or we're going to reapply our country's founding principles and get us back on the right track and reignite the American idea for the American people.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor, Neil King Jr. of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What did you hear in the president's speech last night? After 2 weeks of big politics, how do you now see the contest, the choice? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are in Charlotte today, where Democrats gathered on the heels of the GOP in Tampa. Joining us from Washington is Gail Chadwick, Washington politics editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Also from Washington, Neil King, junior political reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He was with us in Tampa. Neil King, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Gail, and Neil.
All right, a little more of that president last night. It was a sober speech. He said, quoting here, "The truth is, it will take more than a few years for us to solve challenges that have built up over decades." But he offered a path, he said, to really meet those challenges, a harder path.
Know this, America. Our problems can be solved. Our challenges can be met. The path we offer may be harder, but it leads to a better place, and I'm asking you to choose that future.
And the president went after the GOP, what he described as kind of a tax cut answer to any problem.
They want your vote, but they don't want you to know their plan. And that's because all they have to offer is the same prescriptions they've had for the last 30 years. Have a surplus? Try a tax cut. Deficit too high? Try another. Feel a cold coming on? Take two tax cuts, roll back some regulations, and call us in the morning.
Gail Chadwick in Washington, there's a moment of levity, but it was a rare one in that speech last night. This was not a Rocky Mountain High of 2008. This was a very sober sitting president asking for votes for reelection.
No, he was grappling with diminished expectations. And you heard Governor Romney in his speech, in effect, say this president promised you to, you know, roll back the tides, to, you know, change the climate. I'm promising you a better life. So that's, I think, a big part of this speech was to, yes, rouse the base, but not go way out on a limb, especially knowing that the day after that speech was going to be job numbers again. Very discouraging, only 103,000 new jobs. And there's a kind of, you know, in a sense, a sitting president isn't just competing with a rival politician. He's competing with reality. And reality spoke very loudly this morning with these job numbers.
And one can imagine the president may have already had those in his ear. 103,000 new private sector jobs, a net loss in public jobs, so a net of 96,000 jobs only in August. That was down from 140,000 in July, below expectations. Neil King, the president has a pretty good, I'm sure, dashboard on what's coming on this front. But he's been thinking about this speech for a long time, and it seemed a kind of deliberate countertone to his first time out 4 years ago, Neil.
Yeah, it was profoundly different in many ways. I mean, so much less uplifting, so much more in a way like a State of the Union address. I was a bit astonished when he, you know, went into all these various areas somewhat in depth. I mean, he talked about education, about his energy policy. He talked about global warming, which is a great thing to talk about, but it's sort of fallen off the radar a bit. You know, he talked about education policy. At heart, you know, he was asking for loyalty, the loyalty of his people, for the people who had voted for him. There was an ingredient of asking for forgiveness. A fascinating line where he quoted Abraham Lincoln and talked about his own failings. He was asking for continued trust, obviously, for another 4 years. But he talked a little bit using the word plans, but for the most part, he talked about goals. And we have these goals, whether it be on the economy, on exports, on energy, whatever it might be, and we need 4 more years to see them. And it was I found it to be somewhat stale in some ways and a little bit flat. And it seemed that was the take kind of widely shared, around the folks in Charlotte and elsewhere. I think in a little bit because it was such a hard act to follow coming the day after Bill Clinton's speech, which was not only 10 minutes longer, but so much more sweeping. And I think it's so much more effective in the way that he went after the Republican proposition and what they think they're going to bring if they take the White House.
There was a very interesting arc to the energy of this weekend. Yes, Bill Clinton the night before had been all lit up there, and he had a lot to say, 48 minutes, including in this little passage, kind of looking to absolve President Obama from the lack of a big rebound in Obama's administration. Here he is Wednesday night in Charlotte.
President Obama started with a much weaker economy than I did. Listen to me now. No president, not me, not any of my predecessors, no one could have fully repaired all the damage that he found in just 4 years.
Former President Bill Clinton laying it down there for Barack Obama. And, of course, Mitt Romney watching all of this. Here he was at an event in Concord, New Hampshire. This was Thursday. The Republican contender for the White House said he didn't expect much from the president's speech. He said this isn't time for new promises. He wants a report card on what these last 4 years have brought.
This is a time not for him to start restating new promises, but to report on the promises he made. I think he wants a promises reset. We want a report on the promises he made.
Yes, they do. Jack, what do you make of this whole week in Charlotte? There was a lot of energy in that hall. How did it translate? You were watching the whole thing.
Well, according to people who were there, the reporters you hear on the talking heads you hear, it was a convention that had a markedly more positive tone on the floor among the delegates than did the GOP convention, perhaps with the exception of the electrifying Paul Ryan speech, and that there was a reluctance on the part of the delegates there to embrace Mitt Romney. That's been true all along, whereas you could see that there was clearly fervor for Mr. Obama on that floor. Now, does that translate? Is that a sort of, will that just move out into the broader electorate? We don't know. What I found striking about the speech was its philosophy. He proposed an alternative to individualism. That's the strongest strain in America's political culture, no doubt. But there's another strain. And it was something he studied at Harvard Law School, something that's been rediscovered by historians like Bernard Bailyn and Gordon Wood in our time. And that is Republicanism, small r, the belief that the whole is more important than the part. No man is a true Republican, as a Pennsylvanian wrote in 1776, that will not give up his single voice to that of the public. The founders did not believe in individualism. They believed in the good of the whole. And that is a strain. Socialism isn't a strain, but Republicanism is in our political culture. He struck that, and he said, Americans, remember, this is part of who we are, too. Not just freedom. Freedom is important, but responsibility to one another.
Small r. President Clinton, of course, had picked that up the night before, saying, are we all in this together, or are we on our own? Gail, what about that? The alternative to individualism as a big philosophical campaign stake in the ground in this year, 2012.
It's, as both sides are saying, this is a defining election. We don't have them very often. This is really one of them. I think, though, it is going to come down to who are you speaking to? I mean, both conventions appeared to be really focused on their base, and they're reading the same statistics we are, that they're just aren't that many undecided voters out there. And so what you really need to do is to get the people already committed to you to turn out. You know, it's a kind of perilous approach for a lot of reasons. It depends on whether or not you can get the base to turn out. But once you come back and have to start governing, you've had two sides that have made no appeal to the middle. And so, you know, regardless of whether you see this as a government that's profoundly based on a Republican collective sense or on the individual sense, it's got to work. And it's not clear that this election is going to produce an outcome that can work any better than the government did in the last 4 years. And by government, I mean the Senate, the House, the President, producing outcomes that make sense.
Neil, what about it for voters sitting out there listening and saying, look, I just want things to work better in the next 4 years than they have in this 4 years with gridlock and all the rest? Did they hear signals of that last night, Neil?
Well, you know, again, Obama is obviously pledging that he will do more. He will meet his goals if only given more time, and talked about the gridlock that's out there. I don't think anybody's really able to handicap which of these two men is necessarily likely to break through that more. It is this huge, immovable object that's out there come next January, no matter who wins, and it's a grim one.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour, wrapping up two big weeks of politics. The president's speech last night, Bill Clinton's big speech this week before his party, and the choice laid out as we roll toward November. Neil King joins us from the Wall Street Journal. Gail Chadwick from the Christian Science Monitor. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is here. Joe Biden had his moment last night. Here he was with his passionate appeal and descriptor of his colleague and boss, Barack Obama.
This man has courage in his soul, compassion in his heart, and a spine of steel. And because of all the actions he took, because of the calls he made, because of the determination of American workers and the unparalleled bravery of our special forces, we can now proudly say what you've heard me say the last 6 months. Osama bin Laden is dead, and General Motors is alive.
Joe Biden, last night in Charlotte. Boy, oh boy, does he love that line. It's more than a line, Jack. They're two facts. How far do you think they go?
Well, you know, I think the crucial question is how far do they go in Ohio? According to some estimates, 1 in 8 jobs in Ohio is tied one way or another to the auto industry. The president has been ahead there. He continues to be ahead there. Traditionally, almost primordially, Republicans have not been able to win the White House without taking Ohio. And if that bailout yields Ohio and Ohio alone, that's going to be a tremendous gain for the president. By the way, I just learned this morning that the Republicans have stopped advertising in Wisconsin. That was another state that benefited, not so much, but benefited from the bailout. Republicans have stopped advertising there, according to one report I just heard. That sounds, it looked after the Republican convention with Paul Ryan that they were going to make a bid for Wisconsin, at least according to this morning's news, no.
So, Gail, when you look out across the national map, how does it look at this point? What do you see in this contest? Or is it still that toss-up we've been seeing just kind of riding along there for weeks?
Well, it's a different picture when you just look at national numbers and when you, as Jack said, you break it down to states. I mean, this election really could come down to Virginia and North Carolina. I was just spent a couple of days there, not at the convention, but walking around trying to locate uncommitted voters, not all that easy. It is true there aren't many of them. There certainly aren't many of them willing to talk to the press. But there is such a strong sense of in these states of being at a razor's edge, and which direction it goes is going to be really interesting. There are a lot of, and there are some perils here. You know, a lot in the labor movement were not happy about the choice of Charlotte in a state that is
right to work
very negative, state. You know, right to work state, very negative to labor unions. A lot of labor unions still have not forgiven this president. Labor leaders, who he's going to count on to turn out the vote in these key states, have not forgiven this president for not pushing jobs when he had control of the House and Senate, going first to health care. It's a very bitter issue. And to hear all the talk from the vice president and the president about jobs now, for some of these labor leaders, this is 4 years too late. They wanted to see it earlier. but will they be for this president in these critical swing states as enthusiastically as they were 4 years ago? It's really an open question. On the other hand, if the Republicans win, it could be the end of the labor movement as we know it. And that is something they see very keenly as well. So it's it is such a mixed picture right now, and it really does depend on the decisions that these groups who are deeply disappointed with this president make between now and Election Day.
I want to get back to this big philosophical, the two appeals, the kind of choice that's laid out here. These, on your own or in it together, less government, more government. In his speech last night, President Obama framed the choice faced by voters, saying that Republicans would take government to almost nothing, he says here.
This is what the election comes down to. Over and over, we've been told by our opponents that bigger tax cuts and fewer regulations are the only way. That since government can't do everything, it should do almost nothing.
Neil King, I want to come back to you here. He's saying, look, it's not just a little cuts they want to make. They really want to make it do almost nothing. And that brings us back to that philosophical face-off. Paul Ryan, you heard him at the top of the hour saying, kind of free the American individuals and we'll be back in business. The president saying, what are you talking about? We can't take it down to that bare-bones government and succeed together. How's all that play, Neil?
You know, it's interesting. This keeps toggling back and forth between whether this is a big philosophical choice election. And, of course, in the background, it is. And both sides have put forward their sort of philosophies about on that hand and are saying, okay, choose. And then on the other hand, it still is this big thing about whether it is a referendum about this one man who took the country by storm, was elected in 2008 in one of the more extraordinary kind of electoral moments that we've seen in a long time. And if you go back to the Tampa thing, the Republicans laid out their philosophy, their sense of gloom and doom if we continue on the Obama path, the dire need to change the course of the spending course that we're on, et cetera. Obama laid out his sense that his path is the better one and the path of Republicanism is, you know, each man out for himself and so on. But behind all that was, again, just this person himself. I mean, you saw so much. What Bill Clinton went for to do was to lay out the defense for Barack Obama. What Michelle Obama went out to do was to look straight into the camera and talk to the American people about her husband. What Joe Biden stepped forward and basically did for his time was to defend his boss, the character of his boss, the man with the steel spine and all that. And then when you go back to Tampa, you had the faded Obama poster. I think the core of the message that came out of particularly Paul Ryan's speech was, ladies and gentlemen, we know you fell for this guy. We know what you thought about him in 2008. We know all that you invested in him, and it's okay to give it up. It's okay to realize that you're disappointed with him, that he wasn't up to it, and you should come to our side. So there's a whole tussle over loyalty to the president himself, and they, you know, obviously Romney and his people know that the only way they're going to win is to break the loyalty of enough of those people to bring them to their side. And obviously a lot of people have already moved in that direction. This wouldn't be as close as it is. Now it's a fight for kind of the hearts and souls of that extra 2 or 3%.
Jack, this was a very interesting...
Too,
oh, sorry, Gail, please, yeah.
No, it's interesting, too, how emotional this is. You know, there was a lot of talk of love in this convention.
Yes.
Both the love of, you know, wives for husbands, but also love in a broader sense. You know, Bill Clinton making a very important point. You know, we don't hate Republicans like they hate us, you know, implied. You know, there has to be this sort of love where where it's possible to work together and to connect. He said when he talked about government, he said, we don't think that government is the source of all our problems any more than welfare recipients or corporations or unions or immigrants or gays or any other group we're told to blame for our troubles. So this sense, too, that we have to find a way to get beyond stigmatizing
Republicans
talked about love in the country.
Yeah, Republicans talked about love in a more family-oriented way, in a relationship-oriented way. Of course, that was in this convention, too. There was so much of love you, honey, from spouses from the podium
right.
to the hall and back. It was kind of amazing. But there was an effort in Charlotte by Democrats to relate that in a way to policy. Here was the keynote address. This was on Tuesday. The young San Antonio mayor, Julian Castro, who, by the way, I said earlier this week, was the first Hispanic Latino mayor of San Antonio. Of course, he wasn't Henry Cisneros earlier. I was thinking about our guest there in Kansas City. But here he went after Republican philosophy and rhetoric and comparing it to what he sees as investment in the whole.
Of all the fictions we heard last week in Tampa, the one I find most troubling is this. If we all just go our own way, our nation will be stronger for it. Because if we sever the threads that connect us, the only people who will go far are those who are already ahead. We all understand that freedom isn't free. What Romney and Ryan don't understand is that neither is opportunity. We have to invest in it.
We have to invest in it, says the young mayor of San Antonio, Texas, to eject those threads that connect us or in the Democratic convention or that bind and constrict us is kind of the view at the Republican convention, Jack.
Exactly. I mean, to Republicans, investment means spending, means growth of government, means constriction on freedom, means fetter on enterprise. To Democrats, it's the condition for advance. And, you know, I do think there's an economic truth in both. Clearly, too much regulation can kill an economy. On the other hand, I think Bill Clinton rightly affirmed what John Maynard Keynes said generations ago, that the economic world is round. My wages are your sales. If I'm doing well, you're doing well. There is a kind of mutuality built into the market system. And this was one of the big emphases of the New Deal. Roosevelt was saying again and again, raising the purchasing power of the lowest is good for the people on the top. That's where you get your customers. That's what gets it going. And I think Bill Clinton kept hitting that point that, you know, it isn't just virtuous to invest in people. It's sound. It makes economic sense.
Of course, globalization has thrown a new angle into that, and we've got we've got lots of issues on the table here. A lot of listeners calling in as well. Richard, let's go to them. Richard in Morris, Connecticut. Richard, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. Comments, if I may. Both Republican and Democratic conventions revealed great enthusiasm and heightened emotion. But I think what's important is the facts must conform to the realities of today's world, where, as been highlighted in your discussions, we do live in a world where, the individual is critical, the individual works in the context of a community of ideas and power.
Richard, that's always been the case, but where do you want to see the emphasis? The Republicans put the emphasis on the individual. Democrats very strongly this week in Charlotte saying, let's work together. We have to.
Well, what I see with the Republican thinking, to some extent, I'm an independent voter. Mm-hmm. What I see in my analysis is that the facts are important. And when they say that the facts are not going to get in the way, I don't take a lot of credence with anyone who makes statements when they ignore the facts.
Richard, I appreciate your call. Of course, when things get tough, people sometimes go to facts, but sometimes just really go to core beliefs, and we saw a lot of that in these last 2 weeks. One more here, Orlando, Florida. David's calling. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm wondering, where is the fix from Obama? I don't want to hear, well, forget the last 4 years. Give me four more. I'm going forward. I particularly like Bill Clinton because he specifically said in his reign when he was there, hey, the era of big government is over. This is what I'm going to do. I want to see Obama say that. And it can't be these platitudes, da-da-da-da-da. I want something specific.
What about the goals that he set out, David, on education, on energy, manufacturing jobs? Are goals good enough? Sounds like we may have lost David. Let me get one more. Columbia, South Carolina. Tom's calling. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. A couple of things. One, I wish President Clinton had elaborated that can't fix it in 4 years, especially if it's a financial crisis that brought it on, and pointed out that it took Roosevelt 6 years to fix a depression caused by it or brought on under a Republican president. But the other point that y'all may not hit is going back to Harry Reid's speeches, this election also should be about character. And Jack may disagree with Harry, but I wish he could address what the, again, going back to the tax returns, fool me once. I understand that Romney hounded by the press, said, yes, I can run for governor in Massachusetts. Turns out that he, in fact, had filed taxes in Utah during the Olympics and had to amend his taxes just to run for governor. And so, again, it's the fool me once. That was 2002. Now he's asking us to believe him again in 2012.
Tom, let us look at the character questions side by side. Let us pick that right up here. And Jack, I'll bring it to you. I mean, we have seen Mitt Romney. Of course, yes, Massachusetts. He was governor there, ran for Senate against Ted Kennedy earlier. There's been a lot of time for people to look at his character there. And it was the Republicans did their best to frame and highlight it last week. This week, we see the president revealed in some ways by contrast to Bill Clinton. You've got this man of reserve, Frank Bruni, writing today, you know, he floats above, he holds back. Frank Bruni's saying, the sort of downside with the – there are upsides on both, but the downside with the president, he loses some goodwill because of that reserve. He forfeits some opportunities. What are you thinking as you look at the character of these two men back-to-back in these conventions, Jack?
Well, as I think I mentioned last week, The Economist, which supported President Bush twice, thought really character is one of the issues of the election. And they really said, you know, competence is worthless without direction and character. And they didn't see character, that is political character, with Mitt Romney. They were picking up on the critique made of him during the Republican primaries, that is, man who's the Etch-a-Sketch critique. On the other hand, at the Republican convention, I thought the most effective presentation I saw was the film that very few people did see, which was an introduction to his personal character, to his moral character, to the good he had done in business, to the generosity to his church, to his good works. And frankly, it was moving. I mean, people, even journalists were teared up listening to some of these stories. So he's clearly a good person. Is he a steady person politically? I think that's the question. And with the president, you know, holding back, I mean, I've heard people say he can't quite put himself into things wholly and, you know, reveal himself truly and so on. There's a kind of racial reserve that we don't dare see an angry black man in America. And so the president keeps that under control. Who knows whether that's true or not? I do think that the president, there is some virtue in his coolness. And I think Mr. Biden brought that out, that he thinks through things, but he decides. And when he decides, he takes big risks. Going for General Motors, that was a big risk. Polls then showed, I think, over 60-65% of the people were against the bailout. He took the risk. It paid off.
A cool cat, Bill Clinton said, but who burns hot for America on the inside. But then character at that operational level, Gail, Frank Bruni's saying, you know, hey, well, that coolness means there are arms that go untwisted, egos that go unstroked, backs that go unslapped. Michelle Obama spoke very movingly as well to the president's character. But what about the operational side, Gail?
We've got a very interesting book coming out on Tuesday. Woodward has an account of the negotiations between the president and the House Republicans over the debt ceiling, arguably the biggest debacle in the last 4 years. But who's to blame for it? What do we really know about the character of either side? I think it's going to be one of these moments that could make a difference. Could direct reporters in different ways in terms of how they write about the character of these men. You know, covering Congress for the last 12 years, one of the things that you often heard was that this president...
Gail, hold the thought there. We've got to come back after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, for those who could take their eyes away from the political convention in Charlotte, after two failed attempts, spacewalking NASA astronauts finally made the repair on the outside of the International Space Station with a toothbrush. From Mission Control in Houston, astronaut Jack Fisher radioed up his compliments.
Been like living on the set of Apollo 13 for the past few days. NASA does impossible pretty darn well, so congratulations to the whole team.
And we're glad they're safe. Tennis great Andy Roddick chose retirement with a loss to Juan Martín del Porto in the fourth round of the U.S. Open on Wednesday.
Since I was a kid, I've been coming to this tournament, and I felt lucky just to sit where all of you are sitting today. And I've loved every minute of it. And
Loved every minute, and it's over. And Unification Church founder Reverend Sun Myung Moon died at 92. Here he was years back marrying 4,000 men and women in a mass wedding at Madison Square Garden in one of the eye-catching ceremonies that caught the attention of the world.
I proclaim that these 2,075 couples are wedded before God, the true parents, and the universe on July 1st, 1982.
Reverend Moon, gone. We're looking at a week in the news today, wrapping up two big weeks of politics with the Democrats' convention, Obama's call to the country, Clinton's wow, the choice laid out here. Neil King Jr. of the Wall Street Journal joins us, Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor, and our own Jack Beatty. Gail, I want to come back to your thought there. A couple of responses online here. We've got, let's see, Greg says, Clinton took us from yes, we can to no one could have. Okay, well, Marchborn says, glad to hear the president talking about what he would actually do to fix the economy. Mitt seems to be blackmailing us with his elect me and find out what my plan is strategy. Well, another listener says, what exactly did Obama say he would do to help fix the economy? Did he tell us why he didn't already do it when he had control of both branches of government for 2 years? Gail, you were on character before we cut away.
Well, that last point is the point. You know, what did you do when you had control of the House to the extent that anyone can control the Senate,
yeah,
that
yeah.
too? And that, I think, is what I'm hearing among the Democratic base, especially the trade union people who had really had great expectations for what could be done on the job front and now are under attack, unlike anything since the New Deal era, on their very rights to organize. So it does come down to, did this president have our back when we needed it? Does he have it now? He can say it, as he did 4 years ago, but is it credible? And that's, you know, it's different to run with a four-year record. And I think, especially against what is coming down to a one-line Republican attack, which is that image of the college student in their childhood bedroom looking at fading Obama posters and wondering when their life is going to begin. It's not just a line, it's the reality for a lot of younger people who are trying to figure out, too, you know, where am I actually going to show up? It's no accident that the Republicans launched an ad the day of the president's speech on, you know, breaking up with your boyfriend. You know, send us your stories about breaking up with Obama. It's very emotional.
And, of course, it's more than just emotion. It's a real big political factor. The enthusiasm of the young was big for Obama in 2008. Let's go to Kate calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say a couple of quick things about President Obama's speech. And one is that I appreciated that he didn't go for the sort of rock star status speech, because I think it's kind of condescending of the Republicans to say, you know, we know you like him and, you know, you're breaking up with your boyfriend, when it's not about the personality and it's not about the charm. It's about the deeper issues and the philosophy and the character and all that stuff that's not just like, oh, bummer, you know. And also that I personally almost didn't watch it because I thought, well, I'm going to vote for him anyway and blah, blah, blah. And I was personally inspired by it on a personal level, just feeling like, yeah, we don't give up. We get up. And if the other people don't step up and go out and do the phone banks and all that, you know, the vacuum will be filled. And so that spoke to me. And also, as far as the college thing, I mean, I'm in college, and one thing he did do was take out the middleman, which he did mention in terms of student loans. You're not paying extra, you know.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
There are things there that are incremental and slow, but I, you know, he's credible in my mind. It's just a slower process than we like, you know.
Kate, I appreciate your call. You're glad he didn't go for the rock star thing. There were stars on the stage this week. Some last night, actress and co-chair of President Obama's reelection campaign, Eva Longoria, went after Mitt Romney. This was a consistent theme through the week of who's for the middle class and poor, who's for those that have got a lot. Here's Longoria.
Mitt Romney would raise taxes on middle class families to cut his own and mine. And that's not who we are as a nation. And let me tell you why. Because the Eva Longoria who worked at Wendy's flipping burgers, she needed a tax break. But the Eva Longoria who works on movie sets does not.
The rich actress does not need a tax break, but she says Mitt would give her one anyway. On Wednesday night, Massachusetts Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren went after the whole system, saying we've got a rigged system here. Of course, she's worked with the Consumer Protection, more than worked with, a bureau, agency in Washington. Here's Warren on the stump Wednesday night.
The system is rigged. Look around. Oil companies guzzle down billions in profits. Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Does anyone here have a problem with that? Yeah, well, I do too. I do too.
Neil Kane, from the sound of that roar, you can hear people in that hall who have a problem with that. For independents out there who may be listening to the Republicans' individual initiative, maybe responding to that call, what about this counterargument that, well, take your initiative, but it's a rigged system? Is that strong in our political environment today? Is it too strong?
It was very strong. That was the most visceral kind of go for the jugular portion of any of the speeches given in Charlotte. And it was interesting. If you combine sort of pour her, ingredients into a beaker and then add the Clinton and mix it together, you have something faintly resembling what Obama was, which is a mixture, a bit of this sort of populist anger, which is out there, definitely. It's out there even on the right. I mean, you saw it a lot during, the Ron Paul people and other during the primary. And then there's a desire for this sort of cooperation, let's do this together, let's figure this out, sort of more bipartisan spirit. That there was more the sentiment, I think, in the end that Clinton was trying to hit on, that we used to do it in a different way. And which will move more people? It's hard to say. I did want to go back just briefly to the map thing. I mean, I do think it's worth noting now that we've come out of the conventions, everybody has said, it's the conventions that the election really starts. That's when people pay attention. I think it is fair to say at this moment right now that Mitt Romney is the one who's looking at the much more difficult map all the way around. I mean, one thing that's the case is he has yet to take one of the states that he really needs and sort of put it in his pocket. He doesn't own any of the states that he's going to need to own yet. He's actually a long ways from doing that. Ohio, Florida, Virginia, North Carolina is still somewhat of a toss-up. If we are a month and a half from now and that's still the case, it's going to be very bad news for Romney, because you can't go into election day itself, being basically even in three or four states that if you lose one of them, you've lost the election. And that is the case at the moment. So it's an interesting thing where we have basically a tie on the national picture, and then we have a much different picture state by state in the states, particularly that Romney really has to win in order to win. And in a lot of those states, he still lags at least a point or two behind.
Of course, there's a lot of Romney money now to roll out on the airwaves, money on the Obama side as well, and maybe a little more ground game, maybe a little less money. Art in Killington, Vermont. Art, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm calling about the fact that gridlock, in my opinion, is caused primarily by the fact that all of the Republican congresspersons are forced to sign a pledge that they will not increase any taxes. So long as that's in effect, how can there be any cooperation and compromise?
And Bill Clinton spoke about that, Jack, this week. He said, look, they can't, they've talked to Grover Norquist. They've signed his piece of paper. They can't take taxes up one bit at a time when we need to do it. For many years, that worked in American politics for an awful lot of people, Jack. Are we at a point now, do you think, in the argument where it may cut the other way or not?
It's so risky for Republican politicians to break that pledge. A recent study found that voters, even voters who favor more government spending, even voters who favor increasing taxes, regard breaking a pledge as a character issue. But add to that, what would happen to a Republican? They'd have a primary challenge and they'd, probably be booted out. The president used to mention two Republicans that he said, I can work with these people. I've done it. One of them was Richard Lugar, primaried out. The other was Chuck Grassley, who in just a period of months went for being for the individual mandate and for basically something like Obamacare to talking about he'll throw grandma out the window, under the bus. And why did he do that? He didn't want a primary challenge. So it's kind of a doomsday machine set up, it seems to me, for a Republican to move toward compromise and cooperation. That's the way things are set up now.
Well, so in that way, you could look at Obama last night with this kind of low-key, determined tone of saying, look, it's a bad situation. We all know it. There's this polarization. I'm just going to grind through it. I'm just going to, do 5 yards in a cloud of dust, the old football metaphor, Jack. Now, 4 years ago, it was all, we're going to change it in a hurry. This is much less lofty, but at the same time, Jack, we have huge problems. Can you grind through them and get around them, or maybe that's the only way now in our gridlock?
I just don't know. When Standard & Poor's downgraded our rating, they said they
dysfunctional politics.
Yes, that was the main reason. Not anything wrong with the economy, but the politics.
You guys can't get your act together. Yeah. Let me get a call right here. Russellville, Kentucky. Graylin's calling. Hi, Graylin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I just have a comment. Basically, one of the things the president said yesterday was, "This time, I'm not a candidate. I'm the president." As a candidate, you can say a lot of things, but when you actually become president, reality sets in, and you have to make tough decisions. We as American people, when this downturn happened, we have to also make decisions. I lost a senior manager job, and I went back to a truck driving school and created my future. A lot of people have just sat back and kept blaming the president. People need to stop blaming everyone for their problem and do something about it. It hasn't been easy for my wife and I. My wife took a part-time job. We have both decided we would not let this thing create problems for us. We had to make things better for ourselves. And actually, we have actually gained in this downturn. So I just wanted to say the economists, yes, they're great, but, most of them haven't lived down on the bottom where we are. So the numbers are good, but people have to stand up.
Hey, Graylin, so what are you doing now?
I'm actually driving a truck.
And so when you hear these two appeals from Republicans and Democrats, when you hear Democrats say, look, we're all in this together, you're telling us, well, I went out and found my own solution, at least best you could put together, you and your wife on your own. Do you respond to we're all in this together or not?
Yes, I do, because I'm a senior, mm-hmm. and it took people to give me a chance. So, a lot of people are going with the younger people today, but there are people out there that will give you a chance if you go out and you ask and you seek that chance. So, yes, it does take other people to help you along. I couldn't have done this by myself.
Graylin, I appreciate your call. A senior and a truck driver and taking care of his own business, looking for that hand up, but exactly what role for government there, we'll see. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Steve.
Tom, when Barack Obama was a candidate, he took a pledge not to raise taxes on any individuals, not to raise any kind of taxes, and 16 days into his presidency, he raised taxes on tobacco in historic proportions that affect lower-income people. So he's not afraid to break a pledge. One problem with the Democratic Party is that they are completely afraid to address Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. As badly as the Republicans may be addressing it, at least they're addressing it. And I'm really worried now with all of the baby boomers coming of age, particularly for Medicare. I mean, these baby boomers, they want to have a vacation home. They want to travel to Europe as much as they want. And they also want the government to pick up all of their medical expenses. Someone's got to address this issue at some point.
Steve, we've got it. Neil King, what about it? David Brooks writes today about the president. Says his goals that are often worthy, but also familiar, modest, and incommensurate with the problems at hand. That is a... It's kind of a Republican view of the president's offering here. What about it? We've got big problems. Who's stepping up, Neil?
I don't think really either candidate is really stepping up. If you look at both of their big acceptance speeches,
both of them went short and didn't go long. I mean, we didn't hear Mitt Romney step up and do what basically Paul Ryan did in part, which is, we've got this huge task. It's going to be risky. It may be hard for us to do it, that is to fix the entitlement system, but let's go for it. That would be the big Republican gamble. And, you know, what we didn't really hear anything along those lines either from President Obama. Basically, what he said is, yes, we need to fix these things, particularly, you know, talking about Social Security, but above all, we will protect them. And it's a little bit hard to mend something that's getting to be increasingly expensive and onerous without at least curtailing it to some extent. So I don't know whether either of them are doing it. And they're both sort of shackled by their different, constituencies. One is that we will raise no taxes under any circumstances on the right, and we will stay as far as possible from addressing the big concerns on the entitlement system on the left. And put together, it doesn't make for a rosy picture.
Jack, our time is short. Which framing do you think is going to cut ice here? We've got a couple months now. You know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago from the Republicans or from Bill Clinton? You know, choose on your own or in it together. Who's got the framing?
Whoever has the framing right for Ohio and Florida, I think. And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, we'll see. As the ads roll out, and they will roll out big as the ground game effort gets seriously underway. Neil King Jr. with the Wall Street Journal, very grateful to you for joining us today. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Gail Chadwick with the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks, Gail.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack, we're out of convention land. We see you back in Boston. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.